Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
Well, we're going to get started. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jim.
Hi, Jim.
Hey, and welcome everybody to the Central Orlando Group. Why don't we take just a moment of silence, and then we'll say the Serenity Prayer, and we'll kind of get this thing rolling. Serenity Prayer?
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. Yeah, the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, grief, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. There is self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politic, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy and neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And what we've put together today is really just an introduction to the 12 traditions. I know most of you. I think I know everybody here. And what's happened is over time, the traditions, you know, at Central and at other groups have kind of gone by the wayside. People haven't really paid attention to them. Or they really don't even know why they're there. I mean, we know why the steps are there, they're to save our lives. But, you know, why are the traditions here? Why did the traditions come about? And so this is really just an introduction. It's going to be 10, maybe 15 minutes on each tradition. And it's really to just kind of whet your appetite. And when somebody puts on a workshop that you hear about, where most of the workshops either happen for 2 or 3 weeks or 2 or 3 hours, and they really study more in depth, you'll want to go to it. You want to find out more. And so there's 4 people going to be here, of course, me. And we've got the area secretary, I believe, Heather. A young man named Rich, who's just coming up on a year and is very interested in these things. And Central GSR, Marissa. Correct? Okay, I've got a recorder going. It's for my personal use. So if you do mention your name, if you just mention your last name, or your first name, your last name. No, don't do that. Don't do that. Just your first name, but no matter what, I'll delete it, you know, for my use only, and each one of the speakers have already given me permission to record. So what I'm going to do is there's 3 major books that we're going to be using and referring to. The 12 and 12, of course, is the one that we're all really familiar with, but also The Language of the Heart, which was Bill's writing to the Grapevine, and when he first started publishing the tradition articles, and also AA Comes of Age, where he goes into more detail and explains what the traditions were for and why they were working at the time that he kind of turned over the reins and gave it to AA as a whole to run. And so I'm going to just start off with a couple of quotes from him. One is, our traditions are a guide to a better way of working and living. And they are to group survival what AA's 12 steps are to each member's sobriety and peace of mind. Most individuals can't recover unless there is a group, and the group must survive or the individual will not. And he was talking about the AA groups as a whole and AA as a whole, and he says, ours is not an unusual success story. Rather, it's the story of how, under God's grace, an unsuspected strength has risen out of a great weakness, of how, under threats of disunity and collapse, worldwide unity and brotherhood have been forged. And in the course of this experience, we have evolved a set of traditional principles by which we live and work together and relate ourselves as a fellowship to the world around us. These principles are called the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they represent the distilled experience of our past, and we rely on them to carry us in unity through the challenges and dangers which the future may bring. Now, a lot of us know a lot about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of us know about Bill and Bob and what they started out doing to try to get this thing going. And one thing that Bill said that stuck out in my mind a long time ago when I first started studying these things was that AA had gotten to such a point where nothing outside of AA, no exterior forces outside of AA would ever destroy Alcoholics Anonymous. If it's going to be destroyed, it'll be destroyed within by ourselves. And that's why the traditions are so important to me, because they hold the groups, I think, accountable, and they hold them together for each one of us to be able to have a place, and a newcomer to have a place to come and get sobriety. Because that's what we come for, is to get sobriety. We stay because we want a better way of life. And that's my personal observation. So what I'd like to do is, if you don't mind, you know, since we've got a small group and we can take questions and answers, and there's some people in the audience that I know personally that I might call on every now and then just to get them to add their experience to this. And what we're going to do, I think it'd be just, you know, simple. Everybody's got a 12 and 12. And I think what we'll start off doing is reading the long form and then the short form of each tradition. And then the person that's going to kind of do a little history behind it will step up here and kind of talk about that. So why don't we start with Mike? Why don't you read the long form? That's going to be on 189 in the back of the 12 and 12.
Twelve traditions. Tradition one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. AA must continue to live, or most of us will surely die. Hence, our common welfare comes first. But individual welfare follows close afterward.
All right. And Terry, would you read the short tradition? You can read it behind me if you want. Read behind you if you want.
Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA.
All right. And I'm going to have Rich come up and kind of talk about the first tradition.
Afternoon, everyone. Jim had told me we're kind of going to say our names once and then keep things moving along. So that's what I'm going to do. Well, I'd really like to start out with the first tradition is, you know, we've read the short form and the long form, but I'd like to dive into it a little deeper in the 12 and 12. So we're going to take at least a minute or two to read some out of the 12 and 12 as a group. So, Luis, will you help us start that out?
Where am I reading?
From the beginning of tradition one. Should be page... Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to apologize, Louise. Tradition 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. The unity of Alcoholics Anonymous is the most cherished quality our society has. Our lives, the lives of all to come, depend squarely upon it. Stay whole or AA dies. Without unity, the heart of AA ceases to be. Our willed offerings would no longer carry the life-giving grace of God. This gift to us would be spent aimlessly. Back again in their cage, alcoholics would reapproach us and say, what a great thing AA might have been.
Thanks, Luis. Pick up for him, Dave?
Sure. Does this mean some will anxiously ask that in AA the individual doesn't count for much? Is he to be dominated by his group and swallowed up in it? You may certainly answer this question with a loud no. We believe that there isn't a fellowship on earth which lavishes more devotion care upon its individual members. Surely there is none which more jealously guards the individual's right to think, talk, and act as he wishes. No AA can compel another to do anything. Nobody can punish or expel. Our 12 steps to recovery are suggestions. The 12 traditions which guarantee AA's unity contain not a single don't. They repeatedly say, you ought, but never, you must.
Thanks. Anyone else like to read a paragraph?
Paragraph, alcoholic.
Take care.
For many minds, all this liberty for the individual spells sheer anarchy. Every newcomer, every friend who looks at... crowd of anarchists function at all? How can they possibly place their common welfare first? What in heaven's name holds them together? Those who look closely soon have the key to this strange paradox. The AA member has to conform to the principles of the recovery. His life actually depends upon obedience to spiritual principles. If he deviates too far, the penalty is sure and swift. He sickens and dies. At first he goes along because he must, but later he discovers a way of life he really wants to live. Moreover, he finds he cannot keep this priceless gift unless he gives it away. Neither he nor anybody else can survive unless he carries the AA message. The moment this 12-step work forms a group, another discovery is made, that most individuals cannot recover unless there is a group. Realization dawns that he is but a small part of a great whole, that no personal sacrifice is too great for the preservation of the fellowship. He learns that the clamor of the desires and ambitions within him must be silenced. Whenever these could damage the group, it becomes plain that the group must survive or the individual will not. So at the onset, how best to live and work together as a group becomes the primary question. In the world about us, we saw personalities destroying whole peoples. The struggles for wealth, power, and prestige was tearing humanity apart as never before. If the strong people were stalemated in the search for peace and harmony, what was to become of our erratic band of alcoholics? As we had once struggled and prayed for individual recovery, just so earnestly did we commence to quest for the principles through which AA itself might survive. On anvils of experience, the structure of our society was hammered out. Can we read the rest, or you want to choose somebody else?
Countless times, in as many cities and hamlets, we reenacted the story of Eddie Rickenbacker and his courageous company when their plane crashed in the Pacific. Like us, they had suddenly found themselves saved from death, but still floating upon a perilous sea. How well they saw that their common welfare came first. None might become selfish of water or bread. Each needed to consider the others, and in abiding faith, they knew they must find their real strength. And this they did find, in measure to transcend all the defects of their frail craft, every test of uncertainty, pain, fear, and despair, and even the death of one. Thus it has been with AA. By faith and by work, we have been able to build upon the lessons of an incredible experience. They live together in the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, which, God willing, shall sustain us in unity for so long as he may need us.
Thank you. What I really love about the traditions is that they really started to pick up right where the 12th step left off. All of a sudden, you know, I got sober through the 12 steps, and, you know, it was kind of the question, now what? But the 12th step is all about, you know, connecting with another person. And that when we look at the first tradition, it's all about unity. You know, when I was out drinking, that certainly wasn't the case. And, you know, back long before there was traditions, you know, when Bill reached out and needed to find another alcoholic and found Bob, you know, he didn't know it. He was just trying to keep himself sober. But he was starting to lay the groundwork right there for the unity. Because, you know, one drunk alone couldn't stay sober. But one drunk working with another drunk, well, now we suddenly have a chance. And, you know, there are a lot of missteps that can come that the first tradition helps safeguard us from. You know, all of a sudden we've done the steps and we know a thing or two, and pride, fear, and anger can still, you know, arise. I know it certainly can for me. You know, personal authority or bickering between others. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I love the first tradition, have that as a safeguard. As Jim had mentioned before, the three books that we're using are the 12 and 12, AA Comes of Age, and Language of the Heart. There's one thing here that I was reading in the Language of the Heart, you know, saying, each knows he observes a high degree of honesty, humility, and tolerance, or else drink again. For us of AA, drink is to die. To love God and fellow man is to live. He knows so well that we AAs shall have to hang together or else hang separately. At first the spiritual life because he must. He presently lives it because he wants to. And, you know, it really struck me that in this, you know, if humility was the answer for me getting sober, why wouldn't humility once again be the answer when pride came up, when I thought I knew better, you know, when anger came up, or any of these issues? And, you know, Bill wrote very prolifically through Language of the Heart is a collection of grapevine articles that he had written. And he often talked about, you know, humility, if that can save us from our alcoholism, you know, why wouldn't that be what we turn to immediately to be able to save our group and keep us together? Also in Language of the Heart, he talked about, you know, we learn that in matters deeply affecting the group as a whole, our common welfare comes first. Rebellion ceases and cooperation begins, first because it must. We have disciplined ourselves. Eventually, of course, we cooperate because we really wish to. We see that without substantial unity, there can be no AA, and that without AA, there can be little lasting recovery for anyone. We gladly set aside personal ambitions wherever these might harm AA. We humbly confess that we are but a small part of a great whole, as it mentions in that tradition. You know, when you go to a meeting or you're interacting with your fellows, you know, you don't necessarily have to love everybody or be everyone's best friend, but when there's a newcomer that walks in the room, you see everyone put aside their personal differences, because what really matters is helping someone get sober and stay sober, above all else. And that begins with all of us working together, regardless of what our background is or where we come from. It's about where we're going. Bill was speaking at the 3rd Annual Southeastern Regional Convention up in Memphis, Tennessee. And part of the importance of unity is, you know, it needed to be here. Everyone needed to be unified so that when the next newcomer walked in the door, when I walked in the door, it would be here. And when, you know, future people walk in the door, it would still be here. And Bill said, for thousands of alcoholics yet to come, AA does have an answer, but there's one condition. We must, at all costs, preserve our essential unity. It must be made unbreakably secure. Without permanent unity, there can be little lasting recovery for anyone. Hence, our future absolutely depends upon the creation and observance of a sound group tradition. First things will always need to be first. Humility before success, and unity before fame. And when I came to the 12th step, I thought that was kind of the end of the journey, but unfortunately that my sponsor reminded me that no, that's just the beginning of the next adventure, and there's a lot more for me to learn about and live the first tradition. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, where do we leave off? Who's the last reader? Huh? All right, let's go to the long form of tradition 2. And Adrian, if you'd read that.
For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, who may express himself in our group home.
Alright. And Dave, you want to read the long, or the short form?
Short form.
Uh-huh.
132.
Yes.
The short form is 132.
Okay, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our new compass. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern.
All right. Something I wanted to, that really struck me, if you look at the long form of the traditions, they're long. And if you look at the regular short forms, they kind of match up with the 12 steps and kind of go together on the same size board. The only tradition that changes and gets longer from the long form to the short form is tradition 2. And what is it? It's our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. And so one of the things in tradition 2 talks about, you know, that it'll come in, I think, when Heather does tradition 9, it talks more about, you know, trusted servants and things like that. But one of the things was that they wanted Bill to shorten those long forms down so they could fit side by side with the 12 steps. But then that was added later on, I think, mainly so we would all understand that the leaders that we thought were leaders, the people that are at our group conscience, that do the service work for each group, are that. They are not there to govern. They're just as trusted servants. And they're just to do what you ask them to do and nothing more. Like I said, Marissa's our GSR, and when we ask her to do something, she brings it back to the group. And a lot of times, the group says, Marissa, we want you to go to area and vote your group, your conscience. You represent all of us, and we trust you as one of our trusted servants to vote for the best of what we think. But we really don't know the answer as a group, and so we can't vote and say, yes, vote for coffee, no, vote no for coffee. When you get up there as a trusted servant, you have a feeling for the group. And that's what we do. We trust the people that we put in positions, but we don't put them up there as governors. We don't put them up there as really leaders. There are leaders, but the leaders are but trusted servants. And a couple of things in tradition, too, that really come to me, and this is also coming from Language of the Heart. It's from when Bill was talking about it. He says, sooner or later, every AA comes to depend upon a power greater than himself. He finds that the God of his understanding is not only a source of strength, but also a source of positive direction. The member experiences a new inner security together with a sense of destiny and purpose that he's never known before. And then every AA group follows the same cycle of development. We're coming to realize that each group, as well as each individual, is a special entity, not quite like any other. We believe that every AA group has a conscience. It's the collective conscience of its own membership. Trial and error produces group experience, and out of our corrective experience comes custom. The greater power is then working through a clear group conscience. And about the leaders, you know, it's harder still to accept the now proven fact that the conscience of the group. And here's something that really comes from AA comes of age that a lot of people don't realize. It's when Bill talks about when properly informed, the conscience of the group, when properly informed of the facts, issues, and principles involved, was often wiser than any leader, self-appointed or not. And a lot of times when Bill was writing this, he was writing it from a first-hand experience because he was learning as he went around visiting other groups around the country. A lot of people don't know that Bob did spend some time going around the country, but he spent a lot of time in Akron with Sister Geisha working with alcoholics in the hospital. But Bill did a lot of traveling, a lot of visiting, a lot of opening of new groups. And so Bill got to see firsthand what was happening out there, and that's why he was the one that started writing these articles for the Grapevine. The group conscience will, in the end, prove far more infallible a guide for group affairs than the decisions of any individual member, however good or wise he may be. Therefore, we, Alcoholics Anonymous, are certain that there are but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Now, you know, when they talk about opinions, the doctor's got an opinion in the book, and everybody else has got one too, I'm sure. But really, based on experience and study of these things is what we have to offer. And it's best offered when it's based on our own experience with the matter at hand and not hearsay. And so, you know, I heard somebody say this, so this is what it is. Really, you need to go to the source, and you need to find out exactly what they're talking about. And a loving God speaks to the group conscience as the majority vote of the members. We need to listen to all individual points of views, including the minority opinions, with an open mind and place the principle of the matter. Will it help a sick and suffering alcoholic? Will it benefit our group, the newcomer, and visitors above that person who's presenting it? And all pertinent information is studied and all views heard before a vote is taken. And that's the way it should be. A lot of times we get to a group conscience, and I'm speaking from personal experience, where somebody raises their hand, and I don't like this, and somebody seconds the motion, and then it becomes a big discussion. And in the old days, when we had a little house next door, we were replacing windows on a regular basis because people were going through the windows during a group conscience meeting. And that's not a joke, because around the country, I mean, knives have been pulled, fistfights start. And it has nothing to do with a loving God. It has to do with what? It has to do with my ego. I want this to happen. I think this is best for the group. Well, you can propose that to the group, but the group needs to be the entity that forms its opinion, and whether you like it or not, I mean, that's the deal. And you know, Bill writes, and Bob also talks about how every AA member has the right to be wrong. Well, every group has a right to be wrong, too, and we're each individual. We're not, you know, I don't do the same way your group does it, I don't do it the same way your group does it, or other groups. We do things at Central based on our group conscience. And sometimes we're wrong. And what we do is, from our wrong experience, we learn how to do it right. And it might be a month, it might take 6 months, it might take a year. But eventually, God, working through us all, will get us to the right place. Because AA has always been self-correcting. If a group is wrong on enough things, we've seen it happen here in Orlando, I've seen it happen across the United States, groups will fold when they're wrong enough times, and they don't learn from their mistakes. And so it is self-correcting. Like I said, nobody runs the groups. The trusted servants need to be left to do their job within the framework of their duties and how they would interpret and apply their own authority and responsibility to each particular problem or situation as it arises. And so, you know, we've got to let people do the things that we ask them to do. You know, we ask somebody to buy literature. We need to let them, they need to have a guideline, but then they need to be let loose to buy literature. We have somebody that supplies our rec, buys our books. We have somebody that goes up to area and represents our group, goes to our district, represents our group at our district. And, you know, it just shows that if you allow the group to be the primary entity that runs itself with God as the voice, things work much better. And I'm going to use myself as an example here. We recently, at Central, we changed our format for our meetings twice a year. Because we went through a time where we were changing our format every month. Every month we had to retype it because somebody didn't like this and we got to vote and then we got, it was hours and hours of meeting about it. And so we went to a twice a year changing. We recently changed it. And because of one of the changes in it, I came to a few meetings and I noticed that the groups were jumping up before a final reading was read. And I went ahead, you hearing what I'm saying? Me, the powerful Jim, stepped up and said, I'm going to slip this part right after this part, and that'll keep everybody in their chairs so they can hear the bottom. And let me just see how this works. Well, let me tell you how well it worked. First off, it ate myself. It really ate at me because, well, I don't have that authority, you know, but it worked. You know, everybody did stay in their seat. And second off, boy, did I catch hell. And I should have. And I even told our group chairman that I was going to use this example, that I was wrong. I did not have that authority. It was 48 hours that I allowed that format to go the way it was before I had to change back. And now everybody does kind of wait to the ending of the readings. And I was wrong. I admitted I was wrong. And at the next group conference, I get to stand up and say to the group conference, I made a mistake. And you know what? Nobody got hurt. Nobody got drunk. I felt it was in the best interest, but I am not running this group. The group runs itself with God as its ultimate authority. And that's enough on that one.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go to tradition 3, and I happen to be that guy too. So who wants to start off with the long form of tradition 3?
I'm done. Tradition 3. Our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover, nor ought AA membership ever depend upon money or conformity. Any 2 or 3 alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that as a group they have no other affiliation.
Okay. And who wants to read the short form? Go somewhere over here.
Jeff. The only problem for AA membership is our suffering.
How did we get to that? You know, how did we get there? Well, one of the things was that when Bill was traveling the country, he was going to different places, and people were writing to New York, And you got to know these are in the 40s. We're talking about 46, 47, 48, and things like that when these things were actually being written, and they weren't approved at that point in time. And what was happening is that there were so many rules that each group was making. Like in Central Lander Group, we have a reading that says, please don't text during a meeting, please don't lean back in your chairs, please refrain from using profanity. Some rules, you know. There were some other rules in the very beginning. You know what some of those rules had to be? You gotta be a man, you gotta be white, you gotta be middle class. I mean, or you weren't allowed membership. You had to be hospitalized for 5 to 7 days. You had to have a diet of Karo syrup, sauerkraut, and stewed tomatoes, I believe. I believe those were the three things that Bill thought and Bob agreed were the best things for us. And so the third tradition really is, you know, yeah. How many of us would have gone through that? I don't know. But basically, you know, there were so many rules that what Bill said is he sent out a notice to every group from the foundation office, and he said, send us in your rules. Send us in your rules and regulations to become a member of your group. This group right here is a pretty large group. And so we have a saying here that you're a member if you say you're a member. I go to a group up in Georgia that to become a member, you have to sign a piece of paper and put your name and your phone number on it. I went to meetings when I was traveling the country in Sparks, Nevada, where you had to put your full name and your address to become a member of that group. And so there were rules and regulations all over the groups of the United States that each group was autonomous. They could do their own deal, but this is the way they were running them. And when they sent all these regulations in, when they compiled them all, what Bill found out was none of us could be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous if we put all those rules together. None of us. Not one of us in this room could make it. Well, maybe Vic could, but I don't know that. Told you I was going to pick on you all day, Vic. What? We were paying attention. Gotcha. But really, there you are.
One of the problems with the rule is don't text is a BlackBerry. You can go on and read the big book.
You can read the big book.
People come up to me, yeah. Not in AA, but in church. And
right.
Mass.
Right.
You need to get off the masses off.
Absolutely. Technology, and we're going to talk about that in the 11th tradition. We're going to talk about technology, but yes, absolutely, Vic.
Sure. Some great presentation.
Sure.
Really being nice about it, but maybe I could get just for a minute a different perspective.
Sure.
On the traditions of AA, what a lot of people don't realize is the program of AA, the Society of AA, almost failed miserably twice, and that was at the writing and the agreement of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous,
correct.
And then the marketing of the book. Mm-hmm. By 1940, they were out of money.
Mm-hmm.
The book wasn't moving. Mm-hmm. Bill was homeless. They had hocked everything. The publisher wouldn't allow the book to be released unless somebody paid cash for it. And the whole thing was found. And a miracle happened in March of 41. This guy from Philly, my hometown, came up and wrote an article in the Saturday Evening Post. See, in those days, you didn't need traditions. You didn't need unity. And we overcame that because the book started to sell once they had the article. And 8,000 people inquired and joined AA. And so we were off and running. But then, like you were talking about, groups were failing. Because they had so many rules, regulations, they were getting involved in other interests. And groups were failing, and actually some of the groups were sending the book back, saying this is just not working. Mm-hmm. And without the traditions, AA might have failed. And the whole idea of unity is it protects the group, it keeps the group in unity, and so that it becomes a going concern. And a great example of unity in a group is the Group Central. I'm just saying one other thing. In 1944, Central became the first group in Orlando. I've been coming to Central on and off for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
You can come, as you know, to Central at a noon meeting, sometimes at a night meeting, but I always come to the noon meeting. And if you're late, what happens? You might not get a seat.
That's right.
Now, that's been going on for over 60 years.
Right.
I'm over 60 years old, so my math is a little bad. 44 to 12 is what? How many years is that? 60? Whatever. The point is, the central is a guardian of the traditions and of unity. And it's a going concern. And yet, all these years later, you still fill the house.
Mm-hmm.
So without unity, without the traditions, AA would have, we probably wouldn't be here today. And I think that's an important reason why Bill, you know, wanted to put the traditions in place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, steps are survival for me personally.
Right.
But the traditions are survival for the group. And it's important that the group survive because that's where the message of that, that's where most people get sober in AA. Sorry, I didn't mean
to. No, not at all. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, one of the things that I was listening to is the guy was talking about, like what you just said, that, you know, the steps prevent me from committing suicide. The traditions commit me or stop me from committing homicide, and if you go further, the concepts prevent me from committing genocide, which is the whole world. And that, but, yeah, I did. You know, nothing up here is original. But you know, one of the biggest things that I think, you know, what they talk about, and a couple things I'm going to talk about real quick on this is, you know, when they were talking about who to let in. Who to let in the very early days, you know, like I said, they were predominantly white, middle class, and male. And there came a guy in, and a lot of people say we don't know, because I wasn't there, we don't know who it was or anything else. But he came in and he said that, you know, he was an alcoholic and he wanted help with his alcoholism, but, you know, he was also the victim of another addiction that was worse stigmatized than alcoholism. And people say, well, we don't know who he was because we weren't there. And I'm going to say third hand, because Dr. Bob sponsored a guy who started the Cleveland group, Clarence. Clarence sponsored a guy who I worked for many years. And the story was told third hand to me that it was a man who wore a dress. You know, people said it was a black man who wore a dress. Well, that's incorrect, because if you study the history, minorities came in later on. But it was a man who wore a dress. And the group members got around, and nobody knew where it was from. Before Bill died, he acknowledged that this happened in Akron, that the leaders of the group there got together and were just panicked about letting this guy in, you know, because, you know, what would people think if we let this guy in? What would it do to our reputation is what they were saying. You know, here we just crawled out of the gutter, and all of a sudden we have a reputation to protect. And, you know, they went around and they had some real, you know, real heated debate over the whole thing. And then one of the members, and it doesn't specify it, and I'd love to just say it was Dr. Bob. And he said, what are we really afraid of, our reputation? And he asked a question. He said, you know, what would the master do? And that solved the whole thing right there. What would the master do? Who gives us the right to be judge, jury, and executioner of anybody? And it goes on to talk about how that person was allowed into Alcoholics Anonymous. He never talked about his other affliction, and he became a great AA member. You know, he did exactly what, you know, we're supposed to be doing. He carries the message. And then there was another threat, and it's kind of funny, because I used a different book to find this one. Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And the next threat from the membership was from Dr. Bob himself. And he showed somewhat less assurance upon confronting the most troublesome and in some ways the most unwelcome minority in AA's olden days. He said it, not me. Women. Women. Really and truly. When the first woman came to Alcoholics Anonymous, came to Dr. Bob, he said, no, this is not for you. Women aren't alcoholics. You know, women can't be, because you got to think this is 38, 39, 40. Real women stayed in the home. Real women who were alcoholics weren't in the bars where men were. They weren't out carousing. They weren't out drinking. And if they were, this is his words, not mine, they were nymphomaniacs. And that's the word they used back then. You know, fallen women is what's used in one of the things. But it's really funny how the wives of the early alcoholics had a lot to do before Al-Anon came around. Because it was the wives that would take in the women alcoholics in the very beginning. So Anne, Henrietta Seiberling, Lois, those people took the alcoholic women under their wing and helped them until such a time, and I'm probably wrong, Vic, but until Marty Mann came in to the New York group and insisted that she was an alcoholic and she was going to get sober in that group. And Bill and that group let her stay, and she got sober. Eventually, all these things have great stories behind them. You can find them on different websites and in different books. Marty Mann didn't get sober right away. Matter of fact, she threw the book out of her insane asylum window at one time and then went downstairs to get it and reread it again. But then Marty, every time a woman came into the New York group, she was the one that the women were assigned to. I mean, you were assigned a sponsor back then. But it was Dr. Bob that said, you know, he had no clue on how to work with women. And it was the wives. And then this happens a lot, and it happens a lot for me when I talk about men should work with men, women should work with women, and they go, that's not in the book. And you're right, I can't find it in you know, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Can't find it in 12 and 12, can't find it in AA Comes of Age, can't find it in a lot of books. But I found it where Dr. Bob said he had no clue on how to work with women, so the wives of the alcoholic tried to help the early women. The idea that men should help men and women should help women evolved as a means of AA self-preservation before the experience proved it wise for the newcomer's sake. So whether your group has women working with men or men working with women, it doesn't matter to me. It's just, for me, I have to work with a man, and I follow the experience of, you know, Dr. Bob. I don't say that no woman's an alcoholic. I believe women have that same alcoholic tendencies as men do sometimes. And I didn't mean to look at Marissa. I'll now look at Heather. You know, I'll look at everybody, says I'm not picking on anybody. But one of the things was that they really had to open this thing up. The next one after women was what? What do you think it was? It was right around 40 or 41. A black person came in. And it wasn't just a black person, it was a black woman. And what happened was, in Cleveland, they formed an entire group strictly for black people based on a black woman. They had two black men and a black woman, and they put them together and they formed a minority group. At that time, segregation was still full force of effect. And so they weren't shutting them out of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were helping them form their own group because that's all they knew how to do. And a lot of this, and Vic will tell you, a lot of this is, that's all they knew how to do at the time. We're learning, they were learning, and we're still learning today. One of the things that I found was in 1941, it was the first man killed on a 12-step call. And what it was is he was going to pick up a woman who was joining Alcoholics Anonymous, and her husband didn't know it. And her husband found out from the neighbors that a man had came and picked her up and took her somewhere and brought her back. And when he came back on a Friday night to take her to another meeting, the husband was waiting outside in the bushes with a shotgun. And he killed the AA man who was coming to get this woman. And so, you know, that is just, you know, a little bit of history and a little bit why I stick with men and I think women should stick with women. What you do is up to you. But what happened in the very end of all of it, where all the rules were thrown out. Every rule was thrown out. And the rule we have today is the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. It says an honest desire in the front of the big book. They dropped that from the 12th tradition, and they didn't even put in there a sober desire. You can come to an AA meeting drunk. I've seen many people do it. They've got a desire to stop drinking. They cannot stop drinking. You know, they just can't do it. But as long as they're not disruptive and as long as they're not violent, man, they're welcome. They're welcome because something's going to rub off, we hope. Some seed's going to get planted somewhere. And so that's the third tradition. Vic, you want to add anything to the third one?
Well, I believe it was an honest desire.
Exactly. That's what they drop as an honest desire. I was just saying that you don't even have to be sober. And I might have said it wrong.
Help you out for a minute on women.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Where would we be today without the women of AA?
Right.
Walk-in.
Right. I agree.
One in four recovering members of AA are women, but one in three serve.
Right.
They serve, women without... All the years that I served at Intergroup and District 18, without the ladies stepping up, I could have never got done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think whether men should sponsor women, I'm changing my mind about that.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they should or they shouldn't, I think is an outside issue.
Sure.
When does it become an issue in a group? How about 13th step?
Yeah, exactly.
When there's 13th stepping in the group, is that a sign of unity?
No.
Does that create unity when you're 13 steppers?
Absolutely not.
Do we have any 13 steppers in Central? That's a tough question. Do we have any 13 steppers in...
I don't have a clue. And I'm gonna stick with that answer too. I don't have a clue.
When it becomes a controversial issue in the group is when you have 13 stepping, because that can create a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the woman can become scared or, you know, you start hitting on newcomers.
Mm-hmm.
That means you're here for a different reason. Right?
Exactly. Exactly. And you should be here for the... Yeah, you're being very honest.
So men don't hit on any women.
But also women don't hit on any women.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Hey, here, here. Absolutely. And let me leave you with one thing that, and I don't mean to cause a controversy, because real soon what we're going to find in Alcoholics Anonymous is the old timers are leaving us. The pure alcoholics are leaving this earth. And so a lot of groups, including ours, have a lot of people that come in, I'm an alcoholic addict. But there's very few pure alcoholics left. And what Bill said was that we cannot give AA membership to non-alcoholic narcotics addicts. And that's what he said. For us to be able to maintain Alcoholics Anonymous and keep it a viable entity, you can't give membership to a non-alcoholic narcotic addict. Now, when somebody says, I'm an alcoholic addict, of course, they're an alcoholic and they're saying they're an alcoholic, fine. But if they're an addict and they want to have membership in Alcoholics Anonymous and they don't drink, I think we have to have as a group conscience, each group has to have their own conscience on whether or not we should recommend that person go to another meeting. We have closed meetings here at Central. Bill talks about, but like anyone else, they should be able to attend certain open AA meetings, provided, of course, the groups themselves are willing. We have closed meetings, most of our meetings at Central. But we also read at the beginning of the meeting that at a closed meeting, it's limited to persons who have a desire to stop drinking. If this doesn't apply to you, please see the person at the coffee bar who has a list of our open meetings and has a list of other meetings. So it's just something that you need to think about. Because eventually one day, everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous is probably going to have tried a drug. You know? And whether or not they're an addict, I don't know. Whether or not they're an alcoholic addict, that's up to them. But unless we continue to strive to keep our primary purpose, I think that's what Bill was talking about, that we could kill ourselves from the inside out. And we're going to go with tradition four next. So, Marissa, are you up? Heather!
Yeah.
There we are. There you go.
Here's
my heaven.
Well, I just wanted to pass out a traditions checklist.
There you go. Start
one of these questions, then maybe your own will prompt. Just go through all their 12 questions.
Boy, I don't want to miss this.
And sure. Go to tradition four. Okay, so can I have a friend please read for me the short version of Tradition 4?
It's
short one? The long version. The long of the short. Okay.
David.
Thank you very much. Someone read the short form, please.
I'm an alcoholic, please.
Maybe.
The position for each group should be autonomous, accepting matters affecting other groups or AA.
Thank you very much. I just want to, first of all, thank Jim for asking me to speak today. I had so much fun this week poring over the language of the heart, AA Comes of Age, the 12 traditions. It really kept me out of myself. My higher power came in and managed the rest of my life because I was just all about learning and studying. So what I want to say is maybe not a whole lot of information regarding my knowledge on the traditions, but I'd like to express my love for them and why. And maybe you can understand that. You being here, you probably have a love or curiosity for the traditions too. When I started reading AA Comes of Age, there was a paradox that happened in my own recovery. I realized that Bill and Bob, at a point in our sobriety, they were dying. And our founders were getting older. And there needed to be something in place so that this program would be around for us. And it just hit me to the core. And it just touched me so deep inside to know that someone else, you know, because when I came in the rooms, I didn't think anybody cared about me. I didn't even care about myself. But back in 1940s, when all this was happening, and the Jack Alexander article was written in 1941, and the groups were going from 2,000 to 8,000, from that to 133 in 1950, they wanted us to be around. And they cared enough of my pain and my suffering and my impending doom that they took the time to say, I want this to be around for my children's children's children. And you know what? I'm one of those people. And it just was amazing. So I became very desperate to learn all that I could about the traditions because I wanted the group, which I'll show a little bit later, but I wanted the group to survive. And the group, for me, is Central Orlando Group. And it's, you know, it was a letter that was written I think, Vic, you gave me that letter that was written from the Central Orlando Group to the AA Foundation, asking them, you know, just letting them know that we were here, one of the first groups ever. And that history just is so amazing. I just love it. Okay, so now you know why I love it. Now I'll try to explain to you a little bit about the history of the fourth tradition and how it came about. Okay, so in 1941, Jack Alexander's article was written, and as Vic had mentioned, there were groups popping up everywhere. I mean, we had all sorts of groups, and it was just a hustle and a bustle and a buzz. And what I read in the language of the heart, and an example that I'd like to bring to fruition is there was a group called the Middleton Group, they called them, and they called it in the language of the heart. A real crackerjack started up where some elders wanted to make an alcoholic center. You know, at the base of the group, they would have the wet drunks on the first floor, and on the second floor, they have a treatment center. On the third floor, you have your education area. And before the traditions, this is something that was just, you know, oh, that's a great idea. Let's do it. Let's streamline AA. Let's make it. This is great. We can do whatever we want. Okay. So a self-promoted, chairman or promoter decided to write AA's foundation at the time for charter. And then of course, AA couldn't do that. So he wrote 61 rules and regulations that this alcoholic center was going to follow, so it would be around forever. You know, this is gonna last forever. Well, we'll just fast forward a couple months into this fiasco. You know, confusion replaced serenity.
And then we had, you know, the wet drunks trying to say, well, all I need is an education. Let's go to the third floor. I can learn about the disease and then graduate. And then, you know, you got the treatment center going, well, I've just been through the 12 steps. I'm going to recruit some of the wet drunks. You know, and it was just a mess. So, and I think you'll find this really amusing of how it started, but there was a little note card that was sent to the AA Foundation from the same person that sent wrote him for charter, and he said, the Middleton group, number one, rule 62, don't take yourself so damn seriously. And that is just, you know, in part of the tradition for, it's a group's right. You know, as Jim has explained, you're exercising your right to be wrong. You know, and that's all about autonomy, you know, and being an autonomous group. Vic and I were talking, I think it was Friday, and he had, you know, just impressed upon me about how each group is so individual. And when we, you know, break down the group structure, no two people are alike, so no two groups are going to be alike. We're all going to come about this thing in our own way. And so part of the second part of the fourth tradition is talking about other groups that we affect when we make decisions. And there was just some people who had asked me, you know, what would happen if we broke off from this club and we decided to form our own group? And I said, well, you know, think about the other groups that you're going to affect. Think about the alcoholic when you move that group and they go pick up the where and when, and that group isn't there. Why don't you move when you consult the other groups or the other people that you're affecting, or maybe when the when and where is published next? You know, and that's part of the fourth tradition. This comes from Bill Wilson's articles of Language of the Heart. You know, the group, exactly like any individual, must eventually conform to whatever tested principles and guarantee survival or cease to exist. This is the perfect safety. Stick to the course or be hopelessly lost. The informed group conscience should be the ultimate authority of the group. And a group ought not to do anything which would greatly injure AA as a whole, thus reminding us of our principle of consultation, making sure that we're consulting other groups that we're affecting. These principles are already outlined in Tradition 1 and 2, as you had heard Jim speak about, and the last sentence of Tradition 4 reads, on issues, our common welfare is paramount. That's all I have. Any questions on Tradition 4? Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
One of the things that I want to say is that because of the traditions, you know, some of them don't need a lot of explanation today. And they don't need a lot of debate or a lot of, you know, going over. And the reason is they worked. I mean, they worked. When Bill wrote them and the groups implemented them, they worked. And so, the ones that the shortest ones that you're going to hear us talking about today are basically the ones that are just, you know, they're just working great. Some of them, I mean, we got to still work on them today, I think, you know, and one of them is the next one. It's Tradition 5. Somebody want to read the long form of it?
Which Alcoholics Anonymous group ought to be a spiritual entity having but one primary purpose, and that of carrying its message to the alcoholic who still suffers.
Alright. And what about the short?
Each group should be Each group has the one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers.
Well, what's the difference between the long and the short? What did they take out? They took out a word.
Spiritual entity.
Vic, why'd they do that?
I have no idea.
There you go. I wanted you to say that.
Bill clarified.
Mm-hmm.
If you just give me a minute. When you look at the steps of the tradition when you come in, other kind of sessions, what's the first thing that happens when you come into recovery? What's the question you ask? What do I do? What do I do? What actions do I take? But if you really step back from the steps and the traditions, a lot of it is what we shouldn't do, positions we shouldn't take, opinions we shouldn't get into, actions we shouldn't get involved with. Right from step one, right? I mean, what's the whole basis of sobriety is abstinence. That's something you shouldn't do. You shouldn't drink. And the traditions are, in the most part, things that we should not do. We shouldn't break anonymity. But tradition five is what? That's the thing that we should do. That's the primary purpose of AA. And, you know, when AA became successful, when it was apparent that AA was going to be a great success, powers to be at the time went to Bill Wilson. He was a very public issue, and they said, Bill, why don't you open this up to everybody? We hear that question today, don't we, in some meetings. Why don't we just open this up to everything's anonymous. You know, what are some addictions that we have?
Sex.
Cocaine addiction, sex, gambling, computer. What about narcotics?
Eating.
Eating. Well, let's say you're at a meeting one day and you got an eating addict, alcoholic addict, a cocaine addict, a narcotics addict, a computer addict, and I like that you always use the cross-dresser addict. And suppose everybody wanted, what would happen? You have identification is totally lost. So Bill answered the question by saying what AA is and what, when he said what it was so, such wisdom in this and such brevity. It's recorded. There is a handout where it's recorded. He said, the purpose of an AA group is sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the working and teaching of the 12 steps of recovery. And an AA group is nothing more than that and nothing less than that. So it's sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the working and the teaching of the 12 steps of recovery. I like to say, you know, with 27 years of sobriety, that I'm a teacher. That's what I like to do. I'm a teacher. Well, people sometimes get upset at that. How dare you? What makes you think you're an expert on this? But every group has to have teachers. They gotta have Heathers and Jens and the folks in here.
We're not a paid teacher.
We're not a paid teacher. That's tradition.
That, we're getting to that one. We're getting to that tradition.
Anyway. But, the sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the working and teaching of the 12 steps of recovery. And that's all AA is, and that's tradition.
Very good. And let me give you an exact quote. The main, sole, primary purpose of an AA group is to teach and practice the AA program and carry the program of recovery from the basic text to the new member. Okay? Yes.
So because five is what we should do.
Exactly.
Everything else is what we shouldn't do.
And where did you get that quote from?
AA, as Bill sees it. Page 79, as Bill sees it. Practice these steps and to carry this message, and in this tradition, the primary purpose is to carry its message, this message, and its message really is encumbered in the third edition cover, the dust cover, I really think. And can you recite it? Because I didn't make a copy, Willie. Do you have it on top of your head?
It's the inside cover of the dust jacket in the third edition. Halfway down it says, but the basic text, pages 1 to 164, remains unchanged. Then it says, this is the AA message. That's it. Personally, you know, I really don't know as much about tradition as I should do, or as I would like to do. And I think tradition 5 is very ambiguous, because it does say each group has the one primary purpose to carry its message. What is the message that the groups are carrying? I've been at groups whose main message is don't drink and go to meetings. I've been at other groups whose main message is go to 90 meetings in 90 days. So what? You're telling people, and you really don't know it. Whenever they published the fourth edition, on the inside, live couple of that, they took out What is said was pages 1,064 was the EU message. That's why there's so much controversy going on right now in GSO. And it's also been brought up, you know, to change it back to the working of the 12th edition.
Mm-hmm.
If you follow up on what Pitt was saying, you know, newcomers when they come to EU first, and since the day that I get sober, this is the only thing that I tend to do. Every EU person who comes to EU, they're really confused and they're nervous, and they don't know what the hell they're letting themselves in for. What are they going to ask me? What am I going to have to do? And again, I thank Bill Wilson for having the foresight to write down near the start of the big book, when he said, if you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking yourself, what do I have to do? And he said, it's the purpose of this book, not this one, the big book, to answer these questions specifically. That's the message that I'm asking Carrie. And I've said this for years, like if I can't be 27 years, I'm a teacher, I've got a long way to go. You know, if I don't know what it says in the first 164 pages of that book, and I haven't applied it into my life, and I haven't reaped the benefits of this program has to offer, then how in the name of God can I try and carry this message? What do you know? I'm just a
farmer. That's why I wanted a foreign opinion on it, and I have an American opinion, and both of you have the same sobriety. But the thing is Bill does specifically say what it is and what this message is. It is to practice the AA program and carry the program of recovery from the basic text to the new member. And he also goes on to say that two or three alcoholics gathered together in the presence of God with the primary purpose of carrying the message to the still suffering alcoholic creates the spiritual entity within the group. And that can be doing anything. I mean, carrying the message is the first 164 pages. But also carrying the message is being a GSR, is being a secretary of area, is being a chairman of a meeting, is setting up the chairs. There is service work all around, and each one of that bit of service work, from cleaning ashtrays to coffee cups to setting up chairs to washing chairs to standing up here going, my knees are knocking and all these people are looking at me, it doesn't matter. It's all service work. It's all carrying the message of recovery, and that's what Tradition 5 really holds true to. Is it's not 90 meetings in 90 days. It's not keep coming back. It's get into the book. You've got to study the book. You've got to carry what you've learned and what you've been taught by somebody who's been taught by somebody who's been taught. And I think each one of us has to believe that somebody taught the person that taught you, and it came from Bill and Bob because they taught Bill D, number 3, and they went from there. All right, we're going to stop there, and we're going to go with Marissa. And Marissa is going to do our Tradition 6.
Hey.
Hey, everybody.
Hey.
Can I get a volunteer to read the long form?
Sure.
Tradition 6.
Craig? Problems of money, property, authority may easily divert us from our primary spiritual aim. We think, therefore, that any considerable property to AA should be separately incorporated and managed, thus dividing the material from the spirit. An AA group, as such, should never go into business. Secondary aids to AA, such as clubs or hospitals, which require much property for administration, ought to be incorporated and so set apart that, if necessary, they can be freely discarded by the groups. Hence, such facilities ought not to use the AA name. Their management should be the sole responsibility of those people who financially support them. For clubs, AA managers are usually preferred. For hospitals, as well as other places of recuperation, ought to be well outside AA and medically supervised. While an AA group may cooperate with anyone, such cooperation ought never to go so far as affiliation or endorsement, actual or implied. An AA group can bind itself to an alpha.
Thanks. And can I get a volunteer to read the short?
An AA group has never endorsed financial NDA to any related facility or outside enterprise. Less problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose.
Awesome. Thank you. All right, first of all, I just want to thank Jim for inviting me to speak today on these traditions. And so it's, you know, it's been a fun ride for me in the past couple of years as the group's GSR, because one of the primary responsibilities of the GSR is to the group service representative is to be a guardian of the traditions, which in that, you know, becoming familiar with the traditions enough to be able to, you know, be a competent servant for the group and be able to carry that out. Unfortunately, the traditions that Jim assigned me are not the ones that I would consider myself to be an expert on, so which, of course, is why he gave them to me to study. So I did have more or less have a crash course in reading Language of the Heart and also, too, AA Comes of Age. I left my electronic copy at home, so I'm just going to paraphrase. And then also, too, some examples have been kind of already given, so I want to make this a little bit interactive, if you will. So raise your hand if you've ever had to do any type of fundraising for a particular cause. Okay, so who can give me an example of some kind of pitfalls or hurdles in that? Yeah, well, in fundraising, give me an example of maybe some roadblocks or some hurdles that you come across for a particular cause. Endorsing.
People want proof of what you're fundraising for.
Okay.
You want tax letters for a deduction.
Okay.
Fundraising.
All right.
Making sure the money
is supposed to go. Okay, how many people have ever been involved in marketing for a particular cause or endorsing something? Okay, give me some examples of some trouble that comes from that. Okay, doesn't worry over it. Always go where it's supposed to go. It gets kind of confusing, right? Kind of sometimes
the money aren't used for the primary purpose.
Exactly. So, in case I'm sure that you've ever worked with donors before, when they don't or lend their money to something, they're lending their name to something, they want to have a voice to what that means. They want it to be about their cause. It doesn't always necessarily mean about what the primary purpose of what it starts. So that's where you see on the news all the time these charities get in trouble a lot, because you see it's being donated to these third parties and ultimately what their ultimate goal was to carry that out. Well, Bill and, of course, the first, you know, in the early days of AA, they ran across that problem too. I think that Vic had already pointed that out. Of course, like when they started to go bankrupt and when there were issues, there were times that even the Rockefellers had kind of come in to offer to help out. But then once again, when you have that comes, you know, you're losing what that message is, and also too opening yourself up to giving other people the opportunity to govern, because they're the ones that give the money. They're endorsing you. They're sponsoring you. So, you know, in the early days of AA success, you know, to some degree, there were so many people that were recovering that there were, you know, we alcoholics love to dream big dreams. So, of course, we want to go in. We want to run the hospitals. Heather gave examples of groups that wanted to lend their name to that. They wanted to, you know, rewrite medical textbooks. They wanted to be the educators of that. And of course, you know, in that experience, basically in the end of that, it caused a lot of upheaval. It caused a lot of confusion. And then to paraphrase Bill Wilson in, Language of the Heart, he basically said, you know, the all of these things divert us from our primary purpose, and that AA needs to remain poor. AA doesn't have any business being in business. It diverts it from the primary purpose to help each other. That money should really only be used in the purpose from one alcoholic carrying the message to another alcoholic. So I will conclude by telling the story at the end of the 12 and 12, because this is to me one of those traditions where I think that a lot of us can kind of agree that, you know, it's not really a good idea to you know, lend or endorse our name or to lend money or to take money, so to speak, which also too ties into the seventh tradition, and every group ought to be self-supporting. So these adventures or misadventures implanted a deep-rooted conviction that in no circumstances could we endorse any related enterprise, no matter how good. We of Alcoholics Anonymous could not be all things to all men, nor should we try. Years ago, principle of no endorsement was put to a vital test. Some of these great distilling companies proposed to go into the field of alcohol education. It would be a good thing, they believed, for the liquor trade show to show a sense of public responsibility. They wanted to say that liquor should be enjoyed, not misused. Hard drinkers ought to slow down, and problem drinkers, alcoholics, should not drink at all. In one of their trade associations, the question arose of just how this campaign should be handled. Of course, they would use the resources of radio, press, and films to make their point. But what kind of person should head the job? They immediately thought of Alcoholics Anonymous. If they could find a public relations man in our ranks, wouldn't that be ideal? He'd certainly know the problem. His connection with AA would be valuable because the fellowship stood high in public favor and hadn't had an enemy in the world. Soon they'd spotted their man, an AA with the necessary experience. Straight away he appeared at New York's AA headquarters asking, "Is there anything in our traditions that suggests I shouldn't take a job like this one? This kind of education seems good to me, and it's not too controversial. Do you headquarters folks see any bugs in it?" At first, it did look like a good thing. Then doubt crept in. The Associated wanted to use our member's full name in all of its advertising. He was to be described both as its director of publicity and as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course, there couldn't be the slightest objection if such a association hired an AA member solely because of his public relations ability and his knowledge of alcoholism. But that wasn't the whole story. For in the case, not only was an AA member to break his anonymity at a public level, he was to link the name of Alcoholics Anonymous to this particular educational project in the minds of millions. It would be bound to appear that AA was now backing education, liquor trade association style. And, of course, the man turned the job down for obvious reasons. And, you know, I just kind of want to share, you know, in terms of learning these traditions. And I think when I cover Tradition 10, I'm going to go into a little bit of experience and how it's, you know, been able to reach other countries in terms of, you know, groups that have actually worked these traditions and practiced these traditions into their daily lives and how it's been successful, you know, around the world. And I know in my own personal experience and learning this history and learning that, you know, it kind of gives me a little bit of relief that our founders weren't perfect either, of course, you know, and they did a lot of things by trial and error, and that a lot of times we learn traditions by doing the things that we're not supposed to do. And I learned most of AA's traditions by breaking them, of course, until I had loving sponsors tell me that I'm, you know, veering off onto some other path. But, you know, one of the things, too, that I think that, you know, I mean, one of the good things was I had a sponsor actually have me look up some of the definitions in the dictionary for words that I didn't understand. Of course, one of those is tradition. Basically, most Webster variations and definitions will tell you the etymology of tradition is basically passing an action or a thought or an attitude from one generation to another. It doesn't really talk about beliefs. It doesn't really talk about rules, but you're passing an action or an attitude, and that is based on our experience. So on that note, I'm going to let whoever is kicking off Tradition 7, unless anyone has any questions, comments.
I have a question.
Yeah.
What's the difference between an actual endorsement and an implied endorsement?
An actual endorsement? An actual endorsement would be actually physically putting a name on something, like putting your name on a clubhouse, for example, Alcoholics Anonymous on Saint House, put it on writing. An implied endorsement would be, I guess, maybe or maybe going into a treatment center and that it's implied that Alcoholics Anonymous is endorsing a particular method of treatment by having a meeting.
Implied and actual endorsements, Tradition 6?
Yes.
Yes.
So, thank you.
And I'm going to follow up on that also. Intergroup was asked by a local university to come in and start an AA meeting on campus because a lot of the young college students were having problems with alcohol. And so Intergroup got together with their PI committee, which they should have, and they went out to the university and they started to form the meeting. And the university said, "We're going to give you this room, we're going to give you this coffee pot, we're going to give you these tables, we're going to give you this, we're going to give you everything you need. You know, we just want you to come in and run some meetings for our students." And what the PI committee had to say to them is, "We would love to come out and start a meeting on campus, but we can't accept your coffee pot, your coffee, your cups. We can rent your room, based on the donations that we collect. And the university was just amazed, and they were like, what are you talking about? And the university was just amazed, and they were like, what are you talking about? You know, and we had to explain different traditions, tradition 6 and 7 to them, which I'm going to run into real quick before we take a break. But when it came time to name the group, you know, some of the names going around were the this group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which actually would have implied that university because it had the university's name in it. And we couldn't do that basically because it implied that that was a group of that university. So you don't imply, nor do you endorse in writing or anything. Both of them are, just like you said, and just like she passed the test and didn't know she was going to have a test. Yeah, I know you were. But some people don't know that. Even to imply endorsement is to violate that tradition. Yeah, Don?
I have a question, but aside from the question, I'll just point out
that sure.
My home group, the Pine Hills Grace Group, meets at the ODAC Club.
That's correct.
That's O-D-A-C.
Mm-hmm.
And when that club, mm-hmm. which is separately owned and operated, mm-hmm. charter, mm-hmm. The state, mm-hmm. the 501c3 and all that stuff. When they chose the name, they purposely chose it as ODAT
mm-hmm.
and not ODAAT.
Right.
One day at a time.
Right.
So as not to imply affiliation with Alcoholics Anonymous.
That's correct.
That out, why it's called
right.
ODAT.
Mm-hmm.
ODAT.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you,
Don.
Now, my question.
Sure.
Dick must know this, but
I'm sure he does.
The 12 traditions,
mm-hmm.
when they were taken to, I think it was it the first or the second international
1950 convention. 1950. When they were approved.
1950.
That's correct.
At that time, did they, I don't have it right, but that they adopted the short form or the long form, one or the other, that was adopted at that time. And then I believe in my readings that it was later that they adopted the other. Does anyone know about that?
They adopted the long forms in 1950.
Adopted the long
form. At the last minute before Dr. Bob died,
yeah.
He was the holdup.
Yeah.
Of the traditions. He didn't feel like we really needed them. Bill was writing them and felt they were really necessary. And before the 50 convention was convened, they got together. They were exact opposites, I think, and that's why God put them together, I believe. And Bob said, yes, let's get these adopted. And by his agreeing with Bill, I think they went ahead, and that's why everybody said to go ahead. And it was the long form that was adopted in 1950. At a later time, they went ahead and shrunk them down so they could be at the smaller size.
That's a good question.
It is a good question. They're all good questions. I mean, there's never a bad question. Okay, who wants to read the long form of 7? We won't be here to 5, I promise you, and I'm glad.
They group themselves up to be fully supported by the voluntary contributions of their own members. We think that each group should soon achieve this ideal, that any public solicitation of funds using the name of Alcoholics Anonymous is highly dangerous, whether by groups, clubs, hospitals, or other outside agencies, that acceptance of large gifts from any source or contributions carrying any obligation, whatever, is unwise. Then, too, we view with much concern those AA treasures which continue beyond prudent reserves to accumulate funds for no stated AA purpose. Experience has often warned us that nothing can so surely destroy our spiritual heritage as futile disputes over property, money, and authority.
Okay, who's going to read the short one?
Every AA group has to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions.
All right, let's do a little reading. Let's go ahead and keep reading that first paragraph.
Self-supporting alcoholics? Who ever heard of such a thing? Yet we find that's what we have to be. This principle is telling evidence of the profound change that AA has brought in all of us. Everybody knows that active alcoholics scream that they have no trouble, money can't cure, Always we have had our hands out. Time out of mind, we've been dependent upon somebody, usually money-wise. When a society composed entirely of alcoholics say it's going to pay its bills, that's really news. More?
Yeah, go ahead.
Probably no AA tradition had the labor pains this one did. In AA times, we were all broke. When you add to this habitual supposition that people ought to give money to alcoholics trying to stay sober, it can be understood why we thought we deserved a pile of folding money. What great things AA would be able to do with it. But oddly enough, people who had money thought otherwise. They figured it out. It was high time we now, sober, paid our own way. So our fellowship stayed poor because it had to. There is another reason for our collective poverty. It was soon apparent that while alcoholics would spend lavishly on 12-step cases, they had a terrific aversion to dropping money into a meeting place hat for group purposes. We were astounded to find that we were as tight as the bark on a tree. So AA, the movement, started and stayed broke, while its individual members waxed prosperous.
All right, right there. Because I want to read the next sentence, because it's really me. Alcoholics are certainly all or nothing people. I mean, I'm either all in or I'm not. And really what was going on, I think a lot of us know that, you know, especially in the very beginning, they were concerned about having AA having money. They talked about wealth ruined many men and nations and would it ruin us. Money was a symbol of prestige, power, and comfort and could do a lot of good, but there was practically no evil which you could not arouse. And would AA's brand of spirituality mix with any money at all? And on the other hand, should we have a lot of money, the better to do good works. And that was the temptation that was feeding back and forth. I mean, right when they were writing the book, it was being like that. And prior to the book coming out, they had pretty much adopted the philosophy of St. Francis, which was that we needed to stay poor at all costs, that money would ruin this thing. And, you know, I think everybody knows who St. Francis was, but basically he was a guy who gave away everything and he went around carrying good news to a person for free.
He built churches.
He felt like there was no reason for money. He wanted to pass on the good news for free, the good news that he had. And so that's what AA was thinking about at that time also. And they also were thinking about having the least possible service organization and the least possible money. And then, despite that early tradition thought of keeping AA poor for its own safety, it talks about, in one of the three books we're talking about, that there are three temptations. And, Vic, you know what the first one is, don't you? You know what all three of them are, but what was the first one?
The three temptations?
Mm-hmm. The three money temptations that came about. They're going from one extreme to another. One was Rockefeller, when Rockefeller gave the dinner, and Bill and Bob thought they were going to get rich. And they went there, and they were going to be rich. There was millions of dollars. And
yeah, the original motivation in 36 and 37 was for the hospitals.
Right.
And the thing they did, by the way, the thing you were talking about, Rule 62, that club was in Denver, Colorado, if anybody ever is. I don't know.
No, it didn't say
where
exactly the club was.
What did
they call it?
Yeah.
It started out west.
Uh-huh.
There were radicals out there, so.
None here.
The original intent with the Rockefeller was to make a lot of money.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Money was because that's the way an alcoholic thinks.
Exactly.
Now, can you imagine the irony of this? Think about this. When they contacted the Rockefeller Foundation, arguably Rockefeller was the richest man in the world. He's the first billionaire. And ironically, the first billionaire, the richest man in the world, told Bill Wilson and the AAs that they had to remain poor and he wasn't going to give them any money.
Exactly.
And they were crushed. I mean, Bill was crushed.
Okay. But that was Rockefeller's idea, to remain poor. Bill Wilson wanted that money.
Yeah. World.
I think money will spoil this.
So
is exactly what he was talking about.
And what he did do is he gave Bob and Bill both, he gave Bob and Bill both a $35 a week stipend, whatever you call it.
Stipend.
And he also bought a book and sent it to each one of the members who came to that dinner.
Right.
And so those people then became proponents of the idea without Bill and Bob getting rich overnight. Bill mainly, because he was looking for the money, I think, at the time, but also the early members.
There's a little funny story. Can I tell an humorous story?
Sure, tell one.
When they went, it was Bill's brother-in-law who was the original contact with the Rockefeller Foundation. So they met with the Rockefeller people.
Mm-hmm.
And the Rockefeller people said, well, you know, you guys are going to be a charity. You're going to be a nonprofit. So you should start a foundation. Well, okay, so the Rockefeller trustees told the AAs, well, let's start a foundation. Well, what should we call the foundation? Well, you're the Rockefeller Foundation. I know, we'll call it the Alcoholics Foundation. And you can read in the 12 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
For years after that, it was called the Alcoholic Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So then they didn't have Tradition 7, so they were going around raising money. Can you imagine, close your eyes, and imagine this drunk who just came out of a psych ward knocking on somebody's door saying, I'm Joe, and I'm from the Alcoholic Foundation, and we're trying to collect money. I mean, the humor in that is just unbelievable. Nobody in those days was going to get a drunk money for the Alcoholic Foundation. Well, later on they changed the name.
It is.
This is a tough crowd today.
I know. I know. You think of you were up here. What he said was, you know,
I think I'm talking too much.
That's all right. I'm picking on you. In the beginning, we were trying to stay poor, and then we wanted money. And really and truly, where was the balance? The balance was God was in there. God was in there. The next temptation, and it went to the other extreme, is they got so scared of money that they didn't want any. And what they only wanted was basically, you know, alcoholics were not donating. They weren't keeping the foundation supplied with people to be able to work and things like that. And so, you know, what Bill said was when sober and working, few alcoholics have any money trouble. Our earning power as individuals may actually be double the average. Yet we balked at paying AA's very reasonable service bills. And why did we do that? You know, we were very good at begging for money when we were drunk. But when we got sober and we got alive through the program, you know, early on, we were dragging our heels and we were not willing to do what we should have been doing. And they were coming with the third temptation they talked about. And that was when a lady died and in her will, she had left Alcoholics Anonymous $10,000 of trust. And does anybody know what happened with that?
They refused it.
They refused it, and why?
Because you had to stay poor.
Yeah.
Because you had to stay poor. There was almost $1 million they knew of at the time in wills being left aside for Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, today, we still have that same tradition. We will accept a certain limit of money from an alcoholic, but not from a non-alcoholic.
Right, right.
So the wife of an alcoholic that dies is not allowed to donate money. The alcoholic can donate money, but there's a limit that GSO will accept. There's a limit that Intergroup will accept. There's a limit that Central will accept. And each one of those groups has a lower limit as it goes down. Like we have the lowest limit we'll accept here. Intergroup has the next, GSO has the next.
Well, what will Central accept? How much money?
Come to our group conscious meeting. does district accept money? Does area accept money?
And it is changing, just to let you know. GSO right now is taking a look at that very component, and that's part of
raising it up.
Raising that up, and all that came from group consciousness meetings and pairing with us back and forth to area and to our delegate to New York.
And determining what that limit is and how high is too high and what should the increase be.
Always learning, always growing. Terry?
I have a question that I'm going to ask it anyway. But a club
mm-hmm.
not being AA, can mm-hmm. accept. Can it accept?
Yes, absolutely. A amount, absolutely.
And let's not forget that a group can accept it too.
Mm-hmm.
The more tradition is we're autonomous.
Well, I see.
You know, we are going to err on the side of caution because to not take tradition seriously would be to surely die as an yeah. individual. You know, we're desperate to take as much advice as we can.
I think you need to be really careful with that one because the clubs, I believe Central.
Central meets at a club building owned by the Alcoan Incorporated 501c3.
Most alcoholic clubs, the trustees put in the trust document that they will follow the 12 traditions of AA. So they can accept. They're limited also.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a couple of clubs in Central Florida that got in big trouble over that.
Mm-hmm.
Because the leaders came in and the trust document said, we operate under the 12 traditions, and the club members said, just throw that out and we're going to do it. And what happened is, groups started to leave, the club. Now, I don't know what Central's trust document says, but you guys operate under the tradition, so therefore, you can't accept outside contributions. But mm-hmm. There's a big
difference between two.
Vote up in New York on this.
Yeah.
What's that hole in the vote?
And they'll fix it. They'll fix the hole in the vote.
Can you tell me what the big hole in the vote is? Come on.
I was actually remembering a business meeting of Central and talking about going heavy on the hat in order to make your bills rather than accepting outside contributions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, we're guardians of the traditions. We need to explain that. When the group business meetings are talking about, we can't make it. And as a prime example, less than 12 months ago, we couldn't make our rent. And the Algoland Club was here talking about, we might raise it, we may not raise it. The problem is we're not paying the piper. We're not being able to keep the lights on. It's the cost is increasing. And we said, okay, let's go heavy on that.
And we did.
And we did.
And we did.
The tune of being able to donate to the district and the area and everything else is amazing.
Let's
in less than a month.
But
talk about Central Intergroup in New York. The voluntary contributions of AA members to Central Florida Intergroup and to New York, which you're involved in because you're the GSR, are not sufficient enough to run the service facility.
Yeah.
They need additional revenue. Where do they get that revenue?
They
get
literature.
They get it from the sale of literature
to outside editors.
They get it from selling literature, big books, 12 and 12, and all that literature list. And a lot of those revenues are from non-alcoholic sources.
Mm-hmm.
So they got a little bit of a problem, and they've never really been able to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
So
completely self-supporting would be not to take the literature sales to pay for the service workers at GSO. I mean, to be completely self-supporting.
They couldn't do it.
That
they
comes
would
up
have
now,
to
you know, that comes up all the time.
You wouldn't be able, because, do you close the Intergroup Big Book or the Intergroup Bookstore? No.
Well, let's go back to the business. How do we pay our secretary for writing the book? Mm-hmm. How do we pay her? With worthless bonds, right?
Exactly.
It's still a problem 70 years later. That the tradition 7 is a struggle because the voluntary contributions of AA members cannot support the international. Yeah, I'm throwing kind of a firebomb.
That's all right.
Just think about it.
Because
we as a district, I would always bring it up. We were so poor, we couldn't pay attention. And we're like, what are we going to do? Host a workshop.
Well, Heather, we don't
so
want
I went back. I went back to the service manual that says, get out to the group, write down.
Yep.
Donna, you and I are like, okay. So what happened was, you know what happened? I went out to the group and said, hey, what do you want to talk about? We can't afford to put on an event for you, but would you like to host an event? And the tradition is built in. Where it says, if you're carrying the message, you can pass the basket. Well, if you pass the basket, and it's a healthy meeting on the traditions, the group is going to make a little bit of money to be able to buy their book. So our self-tradition, our seventh tradition, saved ourselves. you know, from a poor district who couldn't afford anything to operate on a broke, but still be able to carry the message to a group, and ultimately the group is able to self-support and write books, right?
Right. Yep.
I knew this was going to be a great one. Go ahead, Don.
Tradition sales.
Sure. Sure, one more.
This was back when I was at the intergroup, managing it or administering it, and we got a letter from the attorney's office.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to donate money to it, to GSO. Because of a will that said that $500 would be given to the intergroup and to GSO, and I don't know about to the area or whatever. But they contacted us with a letter saying, how can we donate this money? Because we keep sending it to GSO, and they keep sending it back. Because it has our attorney name on it, or whatever. And so I called GSO. We found out that the donation was someone that had been a member of Sentinel and had also been a member instrumental in starting the Free to Be group.
Mm-hmm.
And I found this out through my sponsor, who had been around at that time, and a member of this group, Sentinel group. And we found out that this individual definitely was a member of AA. And GSO said, what we need is a letter from someone that is a member of AA that will attest that they knew this other person was a member of AA. And then we included that, sent that to the attorneys in a sealed envelope for them to include with their check to GSO. And
now that would be breaking a tradition.
No, because
the anonymity?
Well, it didn't break.
Okay, because it was sealed.
Because it was sealed.
I got that part now.
So that way, GSO could accept it, knowing that it was from a member of AA.
Well, the bottom line is what they declared for the principle that AA must always stay poor. Reasonable running expenses plus a prudent reserve would henceforth be their policy. No observer or non-alcoholic could contribute to AA. They had to always refuse outside contributions. Passing the basket at a meeting is our way of meeting our responsibility for the work of AA. As active alcoholics, we are always looking for a handout. Part of our personal recovery came in making ourselves into whole human beings again. Experience has shown us also that AA as a whole needs to be self-supporting and independent. And I believe that does. Why don't we take a 10-minute break, and then we'll finish up the traditions. I hope you've learned something so far. I hope things have gotten you interested, and Heather's going to do a couple traditions in a row real quick.
Real quick.
Real quick. Heather?
Okay. Hello. I'm Heather. I'm an alcoholic. Very grateful. Okay, tradition 8. Can someone read the long form of tradition 8 for me, please?
I'm Donna, alcoholic.
Hi, Donna.
Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional. We define professionalism as the occupation of counseling alcoholics for fees or hire. But we may employ alcoholics where they are going to perform those services for which we might otherwise have to engage non-alcoholics. Such special services may be well recompensed, but our usual AA 12-step work is never to be paid for.
And a friend to read the short form, please.
Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in 1936, Bill was broke, as we had talked about. He couldn't afford to pay attention. that's the language from my heart. But Bill was very, very adamant about finding some sort of employment. At a stint, he was living in a clubhouse above meeting rooms. He and Lois couldn't afford their house note. They lost their home, and he was looking for a job. It was not a good economy. He was just looking for literature sales to pick up or find work. So Charlie Towns was owned a hospital that he and Bob recovered at, and he said, why don't we employ you as an alcoholism therapist? This is great. And Bill just bought a hook, line, and sinker. He said, this is my divine destiny. And, of course, with all the enthusiasm and vigor, He went to talk to his group about it, because what? He was doing an informed group conscience. Let's bounce this idea off of other people. So he did. And he talked with one of the group members. After they heard his dissertation about how wonderful it would be for him to be an alcoholism therapist and how he had talked to Charlie, and Charlie said, this is a great way for us to promote ourselves and for you, when you recruit all those wet drunks, you know, into meetings, this would be a great, you know, a lifeline for you to make money. You can just recruit those into your therapy sessions. I mean, this is just what you were destined to do. And so in seeking an informed group conscience, Bill talked to members about this offer that Charlie Towns gave him, and the members said, and I'll quote him, you can never become a professional, Bill. We can't tie this thing to a hospital or any other organization. For you, our leader, to take money for passing this magnificent message while the rest of us, now, of course, here's the selfish part. While the rest of us have to do it for free, you know, why should we do for nothing what you've been getting paid for? We'd all be drunk in no time. So, Bill immediately declined Charlie's offer, and the principle for what was later to become Tradition 8 was in place, and that comes from Pass It On, pages 175 to 177. So what we need to do is be mindful that we're distinguishing between organizing the AA movement, or streamlining, as you would in a business, and just setting ourselves up to carry the message. And so for me, like, I really wanted to understand the difference between the two. The traditions kind of ran together for me, and for a while when the fog was still there, I'm like, well, what does that mean, paid social work? And the best way I can explain is I was maybe a year sober, and there was a lady that came to our meeting, our group, and she was a therapist. And all of the ladies at my group were like, oh, she is so good. She is so wonderful. You need to go. And I had a sponsor say that if I didn't go to her, now, of course, I had to pay her, too, that she wasn't going to sponsor me. And here's where the tradition became very clear to me, that to go on and reduce myself to peer pressure and to know in my heart of hearts, this doesn't feel right. Let me become an individual right now and go back and learn about this tradition. And as soon as I read it, it became crystal. I need to find a new sponsor. and I made my move from the west side to the central side. And that's one of the reasons I'm at Central Orlando. Just so you all know. But it's not doing paid 12-step work, but making more and better 12-step work possible. Now, when I came into the service structure, I started hearing all these words about, you know, going to an area and the money and this and that. And I had to hold myself accountable and become, of course, that individual in the mix and say what is right for me and what is best for the group. And we were very stringent on the money that we spent of the group's money. And Donna would come to area with me. We'd bring our own food. And we would eat on our own dollar. And we wouldn't, so that's not good for everybody, you know, people. But I also wanted to make sure that I was not taking advantage of the group's goodwill. That's kind of getting off topic. But essentially, let me bring you back to the non-professional and paid social work. I tried to look in language of the heart, and I tried to look through A Comes of Age, but where I found bringing us back to the service center may employ special workers is I found it in the 12 Concepts of World Service on page 36. The composition of these underlining committees and service boards, the ones that carry the message, not the paid 12-step workers, the personal qualifications of their members, the manner of their induction into service, the systems of rotation, the way in which they relate to one another, the special rights duties of our executive staff, consultants, together and with proper basis for financial compensation of these special workers will all be matters of serious care and concern. So it's talking about how we're carrying the message, how these individuals are getting money to go to area to carry a message, maybe putting on a workshop and being able to rent out a room. I mean, we are paying little bits of money for these service workers, but it's not paid 12-step work. It's just making 12-step work possible. And that's a good segue into Tradition 9. So I'm just going to run through Tradition 9 because they run into each other so eloquently. Can I have a friend read the long form of Tradition 9, please?
Carrie. Nine. Each AA group needs the least possible organization. Rotating leadership is the best. The small group may elect its secretary. The large group is rotating committee. And the groups of a large metropolitan area, their central and inner group committee, which often employs a full-time secretary. The trustees of General Service Board are, in effect, our AA General Service Committee. They are custodians of our AA tradition and the receivers of voluntary AA contributions by which we remain our AA General Service Office at New York. They are authorized by the groups to handle our overall public relations, and they guarantee the integrity of our principal newspaper, the AA Grapevine. All such representatives are to be guided in the spirit of service. The true leaders in AA are the trusted and experienced servants of the whole. They derive no real authority from their titles. They do not govern. Universal respect is the key to their usefulness.
Thank you, Terry. And can I have someone read the short form?
Jerry and
I. Hi, Jerry.
Tradition 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but it may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve.
Thank you. So I wanted to show you exactly what the upside-down triangle looks like, and this is something that was put together to ensure our future. And, you know, in 1945 to 1955 was an immense test and pivotal time for us in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our elders were aging, and as I had mentioned before, they wanted this program to be around for us, and they wanted our traditions to guide us in that fashion towards the 12 concepts that were written about service. And, you know, after the steps, there's traditions. After traditions, there's a concept, so get ready. And then the warranties. Oh, boy. Put your seatbelt on because you'll never stop learning. The spirit of rotation that I wanted to touch on is part of the groups are, of course, of ultimate authority. The informed group conscience is what we carry, the message. But all the other positions here deal with rotation. If you're on a district committee or a GSR, and the best way I can explain of working service is right when you learn your position, it's time to move out. So we're really not supposed to know what we're doing, you know? And if you've got that individual that becomes a professional and tries to tell you what to do, you almost kind of rear up at them, like, I'm supposed to do this. This is my job. And, you know, we always learn some of the traditions by doing the wrong way. I remember the long-timers panel was going on. I was doing everything for it. I was setting up and doing the cookies, and everybody asked me, can I help you with something? And I'm like, no, I got it. And I go, no, I got it. And a friend came up to me, and she said, Heather, you are taking the service work away from this person that's trying to stay sober and trying to get out of their own head. Would you please delegate? And so the further down you go on the service structure, you become a better delegator. And then your opinion goes away, too. Our delegate has no opinion on outside issues. She carries a message. Anything that your group has an interest in, she's got to make it go to the GSO. She wants to carry your message. So it's hard to kind of coexist in your mind when you've got your own opinion, and then you're trying to decide, what is the group conscience saying? You know, what's for the betterment of the group? And that's why their traditions feed off of one another. And if Vic was here, I can speak when he's not here. He's my teacher, my mentor. He makes me nervous, just so you know. Don't put that on the tape. But I can do so much better when he's not around. I don't know what it is. But he always would emphasize during anything that he, you know, during our classes that he says, you know, our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. We don't advise. We don't tell people what to do. And I tried to look at some history about where did this come about. And as you know, I'm the Secretary of North Florida, and I'm very vested in the interest of where our secretaries came from and who was our original secretary and who helped, you know, write the book and who took care of, you know, all those little crossing of the, dotting of the I's and crossing of the T's. And a new secretary was assigned to the AA Foundation. His name was Ernie. And Ernie was appointed to take care of the role of being secretary for the foundation. And he, for some reason, there were some bills that went unpaid, and everybody was harping on Ernie, why don't you pay the bills? He goes, well, nobody told me. Nobody told me I was supposed to pay the bills. They said, oh, that's our black book. Our black book that we all put together of all these regulations that you're supposed to follow, and it's in there. And you're supposed to, he says, you're not telling me what to do. And that's one of the principles that brought about there's no organization. You know, that we're collectively kind of unorganized. That when we get organized and we try to streamline, you'll have that person at the business meeting going, why can't we run this? Like, it would just make more sense if we would actually make more money as a group if we did A, B, and C. And you're reminded, we've got to stay broke. It's like reverse. It's reciprocated of what a business is. Unorganized, but yet organized. But one under rule that I learned about Tradition 9 is it stems from humility. You know, to be humble, trusted servants. It's hard to gain the trust of alcoholics. You know, we've been there, done that. We can see through people like that. And you're always kind of sizing one another up, like, are you for real? You know, can I trust you? And we want to be that way. We're not going to entrust a treasurer's position to somebody who had problems with money, if you will, bank robber. But there's another place for them in service. There's another place for them in service. So there's three words that I read in the language of the heart is, you know, in order to be responsible to those we serve, AA servants work carefully, coolly, and prayerfully. You know, people come up to me and say, you know, why are we going to let this person do this in the group? And why are we going to, and I'm like, well, if you pray and we're not supposed to tell people what to do in a group. We're not supposed to offer them, we can give them a suggestion or experience, but we can't tell people you belong here or you don't. I don't know, I'm getting off track. Let me go back to my readings. Okay. A sure way to destroy AA would be for us to set up a rigid organizational pattern after the non-AA societies that we all know. Instead, each of us is expected to assume personal responsibility on his own for the fellowship to get its major function accomplished. Unless there is an approximate conformity to the AA tradition, the group can too deteriorate and die, which Vivek was talking about. So we of AA do obey spiritual principles. First, because we must, and ultimately because the love, the kind of life obedience brings. Great suffering and great love are AA's disciplinarians. We need no others. And that comes from the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions on page 174.
Thanks, Heather.
Thank you.
Heather, could you repeat that part that you said before, the two words, it sounded like you said coolly or something like that.
Oh, in order to be responsible to those they serve, AA servants work carefully, cool, like I'm cool,
okay.
L-Y, coolly, and prayerfully.
Thanks, Heather.
Thank you very much.
Marissa's going to be up there for 10.
All right. Hi, everybody. My name is Marissa. I'm an alcoholic. Bill. Okay. Can I get a volunteer to read the long version of Tradition 10?
No AA group or member should ever in such a way as to implicate AA express any opinion on outside controversial issues, particularly those of politics, alcohol reform, or sectarian religion. The Alcoholics Anonymous group oppose no one. Concerning such matters, they can express no views whatever.
Alright, can I get a friend to read the short form?
Alcoholics Anonymous, loose alcoholic. Yes. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues and the AA name or members of the public controversy.
All right, thank you. And can I get another volunteer to read the first couple of paragraphs on Tradition 10? That would be on page 176.
Donna Alcohol.
Donna.
Never since it began has Alcohol Anonymous been divided by a major controversial issue, nor has our fellowship ever publicly taken sides on any question in an embattled world. This, however, has been no earned virtue. It can almost be said that we were born with it. For as one old-timer recently declared, practically never have I heard a heated religious, political, or reform argument among AA members. So long as we don't argue these matters privately, it's a cinch we shall never publicize. Is that it?
That's good enough. Okay. All right. So, here's the participation portion of the Traditions Workshop again. Raise your hand if you've ever heard a long-timer say in a meeting, this is an outside issue.
Hey,
we just heard it in the beginning. All right, so now can some of you give me some examples of some things that either maybe you've been pulled aside after a meeting or maybe somebody's even addressed in the meeting as being an outside issue?
Carol Greg, alcoholic.
Carol.
I was at the liar's table just before the meeting and I was talking about politics. And my sponsor got me and said, hey, you don't need to be talking about that stuff in here. We're supposed to be talking about recovery.
Exactly. That's awesome. That's a great example. Okay, who else?
Florida versus Florida State.
Football. All right. Definite outside issues. Those are some great examples. And this tradition, I don't know, I've been in some tradition meetings and some regular meetings where this, when I especially was in early recovery, this tradition itself seemed to be controversial in just its existence in terms of, you know, how worked up people get over, bringing up outside issue topics and meetings and things like that. When you look at the overall history of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, one of the great things for me, one of my best experiences is learning the history of before AA and learning that, you know, this 12-step fellowship wasn't the first in trying to get alcoholics sober. And actually at the end of this tradition, the 12 and 12, Bill writes about the Washingtonians. And of course, around the time of the Civil War, the Washingtonians, had actually very, very high numbers ended, you know, speculatory. There's no evidence to support this, but the numbers range from anywhere to 150 to 200,000 people in the Baltimore area who got sober. And in the beginning, it started out with one alcoholic to another kind of thing. And then things got complicated. After you had this big society, it became this club. And because the Civil War was going on, it became, you know, picking sides in that issue. The temperance issue in the pre-prohibition era was a big deal. So people were like, okay, we should have alcohol reform. Alcohol is evil. We should be on this side. And pretty soon, there were religious issues that came into play. And pretty soon, from what we understand about the Washingtonians is that they pretty much all but dissolved. And I don't know if everybody got drunk, but the assumption is implied or made that not very many people stayed sober as a result of all of these issues kind of permeating the society. And then another example comes again, of course, with the Oxford group, which also, too, is the early platform, the early framework for which Bill himself got sober. And he was visited by Ebby, who was actually a member of this group. It was a Christian-based organization that, from what I learned and what I understand and read about, basically captures the first six steps of what we understand to be part of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that we work today. Exactly. So, and of course, you know, in bringing in the issues of religion and how that comes to play in terms of and pulling away from the primary purpose, which is to, you know, carry the message of sobriety to an alcoholic. And so, you know, and I've read extensively on this, and kind of rather than bore you guys with the history, I feel like so many of y'all know more history than I do on this, I kind of wanted to share with you a little bit about history of Alcoholics Anonymous in another country that I visited recently, and particularly how this tradition has kind of helped save people over there from and being able to preserve their sobriety. And a couple of months ago, I had the privilege of visiting Israel. And I wanted to, of course, you know, you go to another country, you want to check out meetings over there, right? Oh, yeah, right? We're going to see if they do it the way that we do here. And so it was very strange because I visited Tel Aviv. That was the first stop. Of course, this is the real free, live and let live, secular town. And I started calling the contacts because they don't have an intergroup. They just have primary, you know, all of their groups are very autonomous. They have one primary contact for each group. And I would start calling all these contacts in Tel Aviv, and I couldn't get a hold of anybody in Tel Aviv. So I wasn't able to actually get a hold of anyone until I got to Jerusalem, which I kind of found ironic because this is supposed to be a very religious place. Sure enough, the first number I dialed, the woman picks up after the second, you know, ring and gives me directions to this meeting in downtown Jerusalem. So I go to this meeting in downtown Jerusalem. And it, you know, of course, structurally it was really goofy. It was in the basement bar of a comedy club, so and that was obviously very odd. And so, you know, and it was like, you know, you had, they had the steps and the traditions on the wall. They had a chairperson. I showed up 5 minutes late. The chairperson had me read how it works. You know, and their faith tradition, there were a lot of very what you would call orthodox religious people sitting in that meeting, but they adhered to the traditions and following the format of the meeting. They had a meeting format. It was a first step meeting. They passed the seven tradition basket. They were talking about in the announcements how they were having trouble getting people to come to their business meetings. And it was all essentially all the wonderful things that we experienced. Wondered conscious. And I was sitting back there and I got emotional because I got touched. And then I talked to some of the women after the meeting. It's one of the things that I was floored by when people were sharing in this meeting. They were talking about how a lot of these young women in these meetings, and I'm talking about people that had 4, 5, and 6 months of sobriety, actually had already read Language of the Heart, and I didn't read that till I was 3 years sober. And one of the reasons why this kind of has become a tradition itself in meetings in Israel is because how meetings got started over there was back in the late 80s, you had a group of young 20-somethings that had actually already been going to AA meetings in places like Ohio and places like Akron that already had strong recovery communities. They were being sent to Israel by their parents because they figured that religion would keep them sober, that by making Aliyah they would stay sober, and that really was not the case. So in the late 80s, people started forming these AA clubs and these AA groups around that country. And so the point where I'm making about Tradition 10 is that when you walk into a place like Jerusalem, is very, I'm not going to say a tense place, but it is very divided by religion. It is very divided by politics, as you guys see in the news. It is not always the safest place to be in because there are guards constantly walking around with Uzis around town. There is a, what you would call a green line that circles around that city that separates the West Bank. And, you know, there's a lot of really scary things that are going on. But they are able to set that aside and come into a meeting and not talk about any of that stuff. They don't talk about politics. They don't talk about meetings. Men and women sit together in the meetings where they typically would not in day-to-day life outside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But when they come into Alcoholics Anonymous, all of those outside issues are set aside. And one of the big things that these early people in Israel taught and presented was that they gave their sponsees Language of the Heart, and they very, very actively worked the traditions into the program of recovery over there because they said it worked in Ohio, it worked in Pennsylvania, it worked in Detroit. Right? Yeah. But what I'm saying is that no matter where you go and no matter, and it's it also too, it's captured or wherever. No, seriously, but it goes back to the fact that you can be anywhere in any kind of political upheaval. If you really apply Tradition 10 and really keep it out, you're gonna have successful recovery and have a successful group. So does anybody want to share any experiences or have any questions? Or if not, I will wrap it up. Like raising, kind of like raising disaster, raising, it's like just a mess, like a huge change, like upheaval is a huge change. It's usually negative. Usually, yeah.
I have to ask, they say higher power than even your God.
They say higher power.
Okay.
So it is, when you walk in there, you think it's going to be you think it's Saturday synagogue, Shabbat, I mean, curls, hat, I mean, the whole women are wearing skirts and everything. It's higher power. It's 12 steps. It's the only thing is they don't say the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. That is really the only, that is really the only, like, what do you call that ritual difference in the meeting? But everything else is the same. Yep. They say the Wii version of the Serenity Prayer. Someone else had a question.
The question I was going to comment about the Oxford group that it was, I think it was like maybe 37, 38 maybe, Really, the guy that started the Oxford group was a guy named Frank Buckman. He was over in England. And, just a side note, it got the name Oxford group because there were a group of students from Oxford University that were down in Africa, and Frank Buckman was down there being a missionary, and they started meeting, and they decided to call themselves, or they came and called the Oxford group, because it was a group of people from Oxford University.
Oh.
But,
that I did not know.
And it was real popular. I think of the Promise Keepers, because I know that they had things in the citrus bowl that just filled it, you know. I don't know if it's just meaning men or all men, but it was that sort of a Christian fellowship. It was like that. I mean, they just would have crowds, thousands of people come out. But, and Frank Buckman wasn't really the lead in the U.S. That was Sam Shoemaker of Calvary Church in New York. But Frank Buckman, was quoted in a newspaper, sort of misquoted or briefly, not quoted completely, and had made a comment at the time that, can you imagine that if there was somebody that was a spiritual nature, and I'm paraphrasing it, but that, that could influence people the way that Hitler was able to influence people. Just commenting on the influence that he had. And that just was grabbed by the press and about how Frank Buckman is supporting Hitler, the Nazis,
and all that,
blah, 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 and just the fellowship was annihilated, you know, in the press.
Wow.
It still exists today. They renamed themselves a few years after that, the Moral Rearmament, and it's really the same organization. But that's just an example of how the name gets drawn into controversy, you know. And so, you know, really had the AA, there wasn't a reason for it, but AA was pulling away
from it
too, and they had to sort of disassociate themselves from that.
And part of our disassociation also came from our 12th tradition, which, you know, I don't know who had 12, it's not me, but I'll let the person speak on that, is our anonymity drove us away from the Oxford group, which is amazing how the metamorphosis happened. And the Oxford group believed in one true spirituality, that you had to believe in Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And they would shove that down your throat.
Yep.
And part of our fellowship is with Edward Dowling and talking to us about everyone coming to believe in your own reasonable higher power.
Right.
And that separated us, again, from the religion side of the Oxford group. And those two components are what made our fellowship quite different. And you see, you know, as time goes on, how Alcoholics Anonymous then grew. Just grew. And I'm very thankful to the Oxford group to some of the things that they did for us to get us started. Because Alcoholics Anonymous gleaned from so many different different sources. But it was a divine intervention.
Coming together. No, I'm done. So.
All right. And then we're going to throw Rich up here, and he's going to talk about the 11th tradition.
An alcoholic named Rich.
Finally.
Could I please have a friend read the long form of the tradition?
Our relations with the general public should be characterized by personal anonymity. We think AA ought to avoid sensational advertising. Our names and pictures as AA members ought not to be broadcast, filmed, or publicly printed. Our public relations should be guided by the principle of attraction rather than promotion. There is never need to praise ourselves. We feel it better to let our friends recommend us.
And someone for the short form?
Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film.
So I'm going to back into this tradition a little bit by looking at the long form and looking at the last two sentences of the long form. There's never need to praise ourselves, and we feel it better to let our friends recommend us. And when I started really digging into the tradition, you know, I really wanted to look at, you know, what do they mean by our friends recommend us? Through my research, AA really would not have survived and evolved the way it did if we didn't have the help and support of so many non-alcoholics in the early days, in the foundation days, and even in the press back in the day, if they weren't there helping us and supporting us. You know, these members of society who were still good, upstanding non-alcoholics saw their friends who were bottom-of-the-barrel drunks living under a bridge. Suddenly, you know, they see this change occur in their friends. So they obviously wanted to protect something like that and spent a lot of time and energy. And there's way too many of those, you know, unsung heroes to go through today. But it's definitely something that, you know, I see as an area to look into more is those non-alcoholics who helped us get where we are today. And that's where we also talk about attraction rather than promotion. The 12 Traditions Illustrated talks about alcoholics who have recovered through our program are themselves the strongest attraction that AA has. You know, I know if I go into a meeting and you have someone standing up there telling you how it is, why it is, da 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 da, and then they walk out the door and they forget everything they just said, well, the newcomer sitting by the picnic bench, they're going to be really confused. And that's not going to do them any good. You know, everything they heard in the meeting is going to go out one ear, in one ear and out the other. But at the same time, when they see people who are showing up consistently, when they see people who are living the steps, living the traditions, living the principles, that's the attraction. They see, you know, something that they haven't been able to do, you know, live a good and healthy lifestyle. And, you know, that's where people end up looking for a sponsor or reaching out to other people because they see something that they want. And so that's why they really talk about that line of attraction versus promotion is, you know, walking your talk. And as I mentioned before, you know, our friend Bill talks about in language, well, Bill wrote about and was later put in Language of the Heart, you know, our friends of the press and radio have outdone themselves. Anyone can see that we are in a fair way to be spoiled. Our reputation is already so much better than our actual character. Think of all the ridiculous things that we've done over the years, collectively as a group. Think of how much the press loves to, you know, rip things apart these days. Scandals this, that, the other. As AA was getting first started, you know, the press was left and right helping us out, pulling full names out of articles, taking names out of pictures, this, that, and the other, because these non-alcoholics saw how beneficial this was, how beneficial AA was to their friends. They didn't want to see something like that tarnished, even at the expense of them getting their story, or making a whole bunch of money selling their story, or this, that, and the other. Which kind of, as I said, backing into the long form, I've heard a lot of people at times look at the short form and they'll say, anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And there's a lot of topics and discussion about what is actually press, especially in our society today, which has started to evolve more and more into the internet. And when I look at the long form, it reads a little differently. It says, our names and pictures as AA members ought not to be broadcast, filmed, or publicly printed. So that's a little different than press, radio, and film. So as Bill again said in Language of the Heart, vividly we're becoming aware that no member ought to describe himself in full view of the general public as an AA, even for the most worthy purpose, lest a perilous precedent be set which would tempt others to likewise for purposes not so worthy. It is becoming our code that there are things that no AA ever does, lest he divert AA from its sole purpose and injure our public relations, and thereby the chances of those sick ones yet to come. We've talked about, you know, if AA wasn't around, what would you have done? What would I have done when we needed to get sober? So, you know, I have to ask myself when those questions arise about broadcasting publicly, you know, how important is it for me to broadcast something publicly? You know, could this hurt AA? And if so, you know, would my actions be condemning AA? I mean, it seems a little silly now because we've grown so large, but at the same time, you know, it's not about me, it's about the guy who's yet to come. And as been stated throughout the day, these traditions have evolved through people's experiences. Early on in AA, there were several people who, you know, were taking the public platform. And they rationalized why they would be okay to break anonymity. And they rationalized, well, I got sober, you know, before there were traditions. We didn't need traditions then, so I don't need to keep anonymity. And they learned the hard way. And there's plenty of stories at GSO, you know, that they have in the archives about all of that, too. Even Bill Wilson himself found himself in a little bit of a precarious position. There was a institution of higher education that came to him and wanted to present to him an honorary doctorate. Does anyone know what institution that was? It was Yale.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's obviously a pretty big deal to him. You know, he wasn't someone who necessarily had a lot of degrees hanging on his wall. And I don't know about, I can't speak for Bill Wilson, but I know at times I can be selfish and self-centered, so I can imagine one of the most prestigious universities in the world wants to offer me an honorary doctorate. There's a big part of me that wants to accept that. But he took, you know, that to his mentors, and he took that to his group, and he talked with them about that. And, you know, this is, again, what I would call divine intervention, if you will. This occurrence happened literally 1 year after the traditions were published publicly. So what he ended up realizing was he wrote back in a letter to Yale that, you know, he was going to have to respectfully decline. The tradition of personal anonymity and no honors at the public level is our protective shield. We dare not meet the power temptation naked. While I might accept the degree within the letters of AA tradition as of today, I would surely be setting the stage for a violation of its spirit tomorrow. This would be, I am certain, a perilous precedent to set. You see, Yale offered to say, oh, well, we'll just say Bill W. on there. And they tried to work with him a little bit on it, because they really wanted to give him this award. And technically, like he said, by the letter of the tradition, would he be violating it? No. But at the same time, how important is it? It comes to the point where it's opening Pandora's box, you will, for the next person. You know. So, old files at AA headquarters, as it talks about in Language of the Heart, reveal many scores of these experiences with broken anonymity, as I mentioned before. Most of them point to the same lessons. They tell us that we alcoholics are the biggest rationalizers in the world. That fortified with the excuse we are doing great things for AA, we can, through broken anonymity, resume our old and disastrous pursuit of personal power and prestige, public honors and money. The same implacable urges that when frustrated once caused us to drink. The same forces that are today ripping the globe apart, as it seems. Moreover, they make clear that enough spectacular anonymity breakers could someday carry our whole society down into that ruinous dead end with them. So all of a sudden, we finished our 12 steps. Well, finished. And are studying the traditions, and those old character defects can still flare up. If they were dangerous enough to make us drink, you know, why wouldn't they be dangering us to rip our society apart, rip each other apart, as we talked about the traditions being the safeguard against homicide during a group conscience meeting. But as I said before, press, radio, and film, that's a little different than when we talked about broadcasting at a public level. There's something called the AA guidelines. And they have that on various topics, and it's something that the General Service Office puts out. You know, I have the one on internet here in front of me, because that's kind of the new frontier, if you will, that the 11th tradition is really running into currently. And the AA guidelines is a reflection of the 12 traditions, as well as the guidance given through the General Service Conference in the U.S. and Canada, and, you know, basically learning from our mistakes, looking at the traditions in the past, and applying them today. Because the traditions still hold true, we just apply them in different ways in some ways today as we've evolved in society. So, there are a lot of general networking, social networking sites today. I'll probably use Facebook in general and pick on them just because that's what I'm used to, you know, Facebook the most, but there's a lot of them out there. And that's where, you know, the 11th tradition I see, you know, in the 21st century is really getting tested, if you will. And people aren't quite sure, you know, well, is this okay? Is that okay? So, you know, I was really happy to find some guidelines on that. And they said pretty much the same thing that Bill Wilson had the issue with Yale in the first place. You know, if I post something like, I have 90 days of sobriety today, or my sobriety date is, or a picture of a coin, none of those say AA. So technically, by the letter of the tradition, it's not violating the tradition. That being said, it's opening Pandora's box again, if you will. It could be violating the spirit of the tradition. In these internet sites, people have the opportunity to post. So you could be setting yourself up for someone else to break your anonymity. And it might not even be an alcoholic. It might be a non-alcoholic who doesn't understand. You post 90 days of sobriety and your best friend six states away goes, man, I'm really proud of you for doing that whole AA thing. And it's blown. You didn't intend to go about blowing it, but at the same time, how important is it? It also comes even with groups, you know, on these social networking sites. I'm a part of several groups on social networking sites that are AA related. However, they are unsearchable. If I wanted to find that group, I cannot find that group. You have to be invited to it by another member. Things like that are where, you know, is, like I said, the new frontier. They talk even here about not even using AA jargon on your personal profiles or status updates. Because they felt, you know, again, it's not necessarily breaking the tradition, but what comes next? You know, I know when I'm being a active alcoholic in my defects, I like to push the line a lot. And, you know, where does that line stop when you start pushing it and pushing it and making that rationalization? So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, these traditions still apply. It may come about in different ways and be used in different ways. But at the same time, you know, there's just as appropriate to today's challenges and problems as they were, you know, decades ago when they were first revealed.
Thank you. Thank you. Good job. Thank you. What, let's see if I can do this for that mic. Rich, if you guys would do that for me, just grab the TV and the remote. What are each one of the traditions? Number one, you know, our common welfare comes first. Number two, our group purpose, and the only requirement. All of them are talking about one thing special. They're talking about sacrifice. Self-sacrifice for the good of the group, self-sacrifice for AA as a whole, and self-sacrifice for, you know, personal recovery. And Heather, you and Marissa might want to get out here. And if somebody could close those curtains over there. I've got a friend who does, personally, but he does 12 traditions every now and then. And he had some done well on 12th tradition. And I'm really not technology qualified. I spent 3 hours with somebody the other day trying to get this set to this exact point where if I push a button, my friend will come on and talk to us about the 12th tradition. And I have no clue if it's going to work or not. We're going to pray and hope
that Bill W. shows up and talks about the 12th tradition.
Let's see.
To our society, we have been talking very much in terms of simply avoiding calamity by taking prudent and unusual means and courses to do so. So now the question is posed by the listener, is there no more constructive or spiritual content to our traditions than simply the sum of our fears and anxieties and our efforts to protect ourselves from untoward evils and circumstances. Well, there certainly is. And all of these traditions have in them the elements of sacrifice. Sacrifice either by groups or by AA members. As we look back here, the common welfare tradition. People used to say, well, the drunk, he's the important guy. Well, surely he is. But how is he going to get well in any number if there is no fellowship? Therefore, the common welfare has to come first, and our individual welfare second. Likewise, we who have been prone to power driving have to yield to the idea that we may be instructed by the group conscience. We have thrown aside all ambition to be prominent in the alcohol field as a society. Our members go into these fields as individual citizens, and there they should be. But the society says, no, we will cleave to a single purpose. We have sacrificed the opportunity of raising very large sums of money for this society and for others by adopting the tradition of declining outside contributions. Those of us who had special ambitions to be professional workers, I don't mean service workers in an office, I mean face-to-face therapy for pay. These are legitimate ambitions, but not good enough. A professional class in AA might even lead to our destruction and certainly to our compromise. So professionalism out is out. Those of us who are power-ridden would like to unconsciously, perhaps, and sometimes consciously, be more or less permanent governors of the destinies of AA. But now we see that our strength lies in letting go when our time comes. And this I recognize in myself. My time came some time ago, and our affairs have been under the management of our trustees almost without interference by me for these several years. And that's how it should be. But it represents a giving up, the sacrifice of ambitions, many of which would be legitimate in the world around us, all in the interest not only of the survival, but in the effectiveness and the joyousness of the life that we find in it and cherish so much. In our public relations, we have run contrary to all experience in the modern world. In the modern world, everything is proceeding upon the merits or demerits of highly publicized things. Everything is working in terms of friction and controversy. Everything is working in terms of haves and have-nots. Of large sums of money being transferred from one class to another. We do not decry these developments. We say that for our particular purpose they're perilous. And so we think that it would be prudent to leave them alone. So there is a sacrificial quality that we do not conform to our traditions merely because we must to avoid personal calamity. We defer to these traditions because they seem right in principle and because we actually want them for ourselves. And while other courses might be good, for us this would be the best. In our case, the good could be very often the actual enemy of the best. Now then, I'd like to tell you a final anecdote, which is a bit self-serving. I've had a certain amount of reluctance to speak about it. But I would like to draw attention to the fact that Dr. Bob and I began to recognize in the late 1940s that we had a special responsibility to set an example in the matter of the anonymity. The conformity with anonymity was not merely a compliance with the injunction that we should not have our full names and pictures published throughout the world. It was more than an avoidance of our names being made public. That it would extend also to the acceptance of special distinguishment and honor. This came up, and this sort of conversation between Dr. Bob and I began toward nearly the close of his life. He was fatally afflicted. This is well known. I was back and forth between here and Akron a great deal. He was, however, much up around much of the time. And on this day, we sat talking, and he said, you know, I want to show you something, something that moves me very much in a way, and something, of course, which to me, I wouldn't say so to the would-be donor, it has sort of a comical aspect. And anyway, let me get to react. So he came and spread out on the floor a blueprint, which was a drawing of a medium-sized mausoleum in which he and Anne could repose when they were over the hill. And Dr. Bob looked at me and told about some of the people coming up and thinking that this sort of thing was needed because it occurred with other celebrated people and so forth. And of course, he had declined. And he turned to me, and with that priceless grin of his, said, Bill, I think you and I ought to get buried like other folks. Well, this set us thinking. Did we have some further obligation to this tradition of anonymity? And up to this point, there had been little nibbles. He had some, I had some, lesser universities, smaller ones that offered degrees of various kinds, and well, we'd kind of turned those down as a matter of course. But then we began to think, doesn't the tradition extend to this public honor business? Doesn't it extend to the acceptance of no rewards, even posthumous? And then Dr. Baum died, and he and Anne were then buried like other folks. She had been for a time. And pretty soon, a new set of temptations began to develop with me. Time Magazine, some years ago, asked for a number of us to come over from the office. And I was included, of course. And they took us upstairs for a long, long lunch. And these people were top figures over there. And they listened to the AA story. And they said, well, now we've given you folks good treatment and we propose to keep it up. But now we would like, Bill, to have a biographical sketch of you. And we would like to make this a color paper. And let us tell you, before you say no, that if you make it a cover story, if we make this a cover story, it will enormously increase the impact of the piece a dozen times, maybe, over what the same piece without the cover was. And that our circulation is something like 12 million. Now, we would like to do the story of AA hung on a biographical sketch of you. And I said about the anonymity. Oh, no, we're quite aware of that. We'll agree to keep that. You just have your head turned away from the camera. You'd be hardly inside you. That ball might show a little, but we'll stay within the rules and regulations. Well, I must confess that this proposal was a puzzler. I can honestly say that I didn't feel especially or personally tempted by the lure of the flesh and blood to the biographical account of myself. And said it didn't seem right that that I should cooperate in such an effort. As for the anonymity, yes, they'd keep that, but then I began to wonder what the effect would be on the future. If I began giving sketches of this sort of myself to public media, even with my head turned, once Papa was out of the way and gone west, wouldn't other people say, well, the old man almost did it, so I'll give him my biography and full face on from here out. In other words, it would open the door subtly to car-driving people of the future, people just like me. Now, this was very hard to decline because declinations meant the death of some, and it meant the prolonged illness of others. The impact of this thing could have been phenomenal and brought in great numbers of people. So the saying no was something to keep awake nights about, and I did. I hope and believe that this was the right decision for AA's future. But again, for a long time, the spectres of the people who died and those who might have recovered earlier has continued to haunt me. It was a question of making an estimate whether the nearby advantage of this would be of more value to more people than the advantage of an example that would include the acceptance of public honors in the AA anonymity tradition. And I have opted for the latter choice. It is the best that I can do. I leave it to you and to the future for whatever it may be worth. So, in conclusion, dear folks, a thousand thanks for sitting with me and to the camera crowd out there. And, dear people, at great distances, please have my warmest affection and gratitude. And may God bless you and Alcoholics Anonymous forever.
That's the man who did the cross tradition. Let me read you the long form. And finally, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the principle of anonymity has an immense spiritual significance. It reminds us that we are to place principles before personalities, that we are actually to practice a genuine humility. To the end, that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. We're really glad you all came. If you want to just stand where we are, we're going to say the Lord's Prayer and end the meeting. We don't have to circle up or hold hands. We're just going to stand where we are, how they did in the old days. And the Lord, you didn't have to leave. And the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses,
as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thank you all for coming. Hope you learned something.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.